Good evening. Great to see everybody out tonight. It's dark and it's a full moon. Wow, that's isn't it fun to have this time of the year where the time changes and standard time or whatever. Maybe they'll get that fixed one day. But glad to see everyone out tonight. Grateful that you're with us. Why don't we begin with a word of prayer and then we'll get right into our study this evening. Would you pray with me? Gracious Heavenly Father, we are so very thankful to you for who you are, for your word, for your son, for so many ways in which you provide for us and guide us, and it's through you that we have life and hope and so many good things. And we come together this evening, we're thankful that we can study a small portion of your word. We're thankful for the life of your son and the examples and the teaching that he provided to us, and the records that are left for us to understand, and the great applications that we can make to our own lives, Father. Pray that you would bless our time together this evening. Help us to put things from the world from our mind and to focus on your word. It's in Christ's name that we pray. Amen. All right. I will try to go a little slower tonight. This is a study of the Daily Bible. If you're visiting with us, we are spending this year working through the Daily Bible. Each day there's some reading, and we've finally gotten to the New Testament, and we're in the life of Christ. And it's quite difficult to try to pare down everything that we're going to read in a week and to try to cover that in about 40, 45 minutes. So we went through a lot of material on Sunday morning. Won't step back into that at all. But I thought tonight we might could spend a little time thinking about some of the parables that we find in this week's reading. So I'll try to pause a little bit tonight and would welcome any comments or questions. I didn't really do that on Sunday morning. I just sort of plowed right on through. So I hope to have a little bit better pace here tonight and see if we can get through some of this material as well. So parables. You know, the definition of the word parable is really, it's to place beside or to compare. And so I found this little graph. You know, Kay would tell us that this is called a parabola. This is a graph, something near and dear to our heart. Nolan, my son, is in ninth grade. We're studying advanced geometry, and it's humbling. But I'd forgotten about parabolas, and we're learning all kinds of theorems, and with good thanks and great tutors, hopefully we will make it through this year, freshman year of high school. But to place beside, to compare, it's really to sort of put a mirror up against something and to reflect the essence of it, maybe look at it from a different angle and reveal a truth about it. And so our, you know, Sunday school definition of a parable might be it's an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. It's definitely, most parables are told as a story, and they have a moral to them. And you know, they're different than other stories that we might read. Sometimes you might think of a fable or something that Aesop or someone like that would have written. And I think, you know, there's some key differences there. You know, fables oftentimes have speaking animals and magical kind of things that happen, whereas a parable is just a fairly straightforward, basic and simple story that involves human beings, and it involves real people in situations where there's a, you know, a moral type of a dilemma that's being explored. And one of the beauties of the parable and why it's really such an effective tool and maybe why Christ used that is it's a very effective. It's short, it's simple, yet it's really profound, and there's a lot that we can mine out of those and learn about spiritual things and just different truths, or maybe help us to look at a situation, compare it with something that's similar, and see if we can learn more about its essence there. It's instructive. It usually has a moral principle, we said. And there's an emphasis on what we would call the subtext. So oftentimes there's the straightforward part of the story, but then there's other parts of it that are a little bit hidden, that are a bit of a mystery, requires a bit of knowledge and maybe imagination to understand, and then certainly there's application there that can be made. And so as we study parables, it's important to focus on what's implied in the parable and what the meaning of it was. So really, you know, why did Jesus speak in parables? And there's an answer for that. We're on page 1395 of our daily Bible. This would be, if you want to follow along, it would be in Matthew chapter 13, starting around verse 10. In our daily Bible, it's the paragraph that just basically says, purpose of parables. The disciples come to him and say, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" And he, Jesus, replies, saying, "Because the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you, but not to them. And whoever has will be given more, and they will have in abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have, will be taken from them. And this is why I speak to them in parables." And then there's a quote here from Isaiah. It says, "Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand." And then he goes on, "You will be ever hearing, but never understanding. You will be ever seeing, but not perceiving." Excuse me. Really dry tonight, sorry. "For this people's heart has become calloused. They hardly hear with their eyes, or they have closed their eyes. They hear with their ears or close their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn, and I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. For truly I tell you, many prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see, but did not see it, and to hear what you hear, but did not hear it. You know, similar things one page over, a couple pages over, in 1397. Parables are fulfilling prophecy. This is in Matthew chapter 13, around verse 34. It says, you know, "With many parables, similar parables, Jesus spoke the word to them as much as they could understand. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. But when he was alone with his own disciples, he explained everything. So it was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet." And this is from the Psalms. It says, "I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the creation of the world." And so that's a little bit about maybe why Jesus taught in parables. He's speaking a little bit in sign, and it's certainly what was prophesied about the way that he would teach. So I thought tonight, I've got about seven parables. Maybe that's ambitious, but we'll try to get through as many as we can and just kind of hit the highlights of those and understand that. So the first one, page 1424. No surprise if you know me. This is my favorite parable. I really, really have always liked the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I guess it's a parable that speaks to a lot of people who, you know, work in the healthcare profession. It's just it just kind of gets to the essence of maybe what drives us and what, you know, helps us get out of bed every morning and go about a secular occupation, helping people. It's one that a lot of us find inspiration from. So the Good Samaritan, we'll start on page 1424. This is Luke chapter 10, around verse 25. You know, he starts off with a pretty good question here. It says, "On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. 'Teacher,' he said, 'what must I do to inherit eternal life?'" It's a great question. Very profound question. It's probably the most important question we can ask. And so in good Socratic manner, you know, Jesus answers the question with a question, kind of testing the man's heart to see what he would say. Jesus says, "Well, what's written in the law? What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And there's a pretty good answer that this fellow gives, this expert in the law. He says, "Well, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." That's a great answer. You know, Jesus would say those are the two commandments. On those two hang all of the law and the prophets. If we can do those things, that puts a lot of stuff in order and helps us with the way we ought to order our lives here and prepare for the life to come. So Jesus commends him. "You've answered correctly. Do this and you will live." You know, the conversation could have probably ended right there and that would have been pretty good. But it goes a little bit further. Maybe takes a bit of a dark turn. You know, the man wanting to justify himself and kind of wonder a little bit about what that means and You know, I think Jesus maybe knew what was in this man's heart and it certainly set up this parable and helped him to maybe reveal something about himself. So the man says, well, who is my neighbor? Kind of a tricky question for Jesus, and we've seen him deal with tricky questions and situations before. So we know the story, right? It's the man's going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Jerusalem's high up on a mountain. Somewhere I read there's about a 3,500-foot drop from where Jerusalem is down toward the Dead Sea to Jericho. And that road was fairly notorious for robbers and people that wanted to do evil and steal. So here's this man traveling on this road, and certainly enough, the robbers find him, and they strip him of his clothes, they beat him, they leave him half dead. And so here's this poor guy laying on the side of the road. He's been mugged, he's been beaten, half dead, you know, in bad situation. You just think about it, the guy looks up, and who does he see coming? Ah, it's a priest. Surely I'm going to get some relief here, but we know what happens. The priest sees him and he kind of goes to the other side, doesn't want to deal with it. Waits a little longer, a Levite comes by, same thing. But then there's this most unlikely of saviors, the Samaritan, that would come along there. The Samaritans, we know, were hated by the Jews. They were seen as, you know, half-breed people. They were, you know, didn't want to associate with them, didn't want to go through their territory. It just was a really awful bad blood, not to, you know, make a pun, but bad blood between the Jews and the Samaritans. But here's the Samaritan, sees him and he takes pity on him. He, you know, binds the man's wounds, treats him, picks him up, puts him on the donkey, takes him to the inn, pays for it, and says, you know, I'll give you something to the innkeeper, and in a couple of days, if I come back, if you need some more, I'll take care of that as well. And so Jesus asked the question, you know, which of the three was the neighbor? And then the expert in the law really has nothing to say, but, you know, the one who has mercy on him. And then that great command from Jesus, go and do likewise. So just I love that story. I've always loved that story. And such wonderful things. I love that in, you know, basically four or five paragraphs, we get the essence of just a wonderful truth. I love how the characters are, you know, developed and all the situations that go with that, and what wonderful truth that we can learn from that. So go and have mercy, and everyone is our neighbor. We should know that. We should love our neighbor as ourselves, as it says earlier on, and everybody's our neighbor. So that's a good Samaritan. I'll stop for a moment. Any observations or comments about him? Yeah. And you love how Jesus... Okay. How we can cut to the essence of things and really know what's in the heart and say exactly that right thing. You know, go have mercy on the Samaritan. You know, go and sell what you have, or all the different situations. He knows what the heart of people is. So good teaching there. Next one, I'm going to just call it, it's really three in one. It's the lost ones. And so page 1429, we have three situations here where there's, you know, a lost sheep, there's a lost coin, and then there's the lost son. And so the lost sheep and the lost coin, you know, one in 99 sheep. You know, come on, that's a rounding error. That's close enough, isn't it? You know, 99 still probably an A+ in most books. Can't we just let that one go? You know, they're all in here. It's all good. I got most of them. That's not what he says. He goes out and he seeks diligently for that one that is lost. Same thing with the woman who has the 10 coins. You know, she's, you think about, I mean, people don't have savings accounts, 401ks back in these days. 10 coins was, you know, 10 days' wages, basically, and that's her grocery money for the next couple of weeks. So losing, you know, a tenth of that, losing one of those coins would be quite detrimental. And a couple of points in these parables, you know, the one is worth the search. And that's what the Lord would have us to know. You know, he cares for all of us. He cares for that one that is lost. And you see the diligence that the people are seeking in the parable, the diligence that he has for finding lost souls, and then the great rejoicing that comes with those once those that sheep or that coin or that soul is found. And it's not that he doesn't care about the 99 or the other 9 coins or whatever. It's just how wonderful it is that now the whole group is in the fold together. The lost son is a little bit different there too, but a lot of, you know, rejoicing and all that goes with that. And I think, you know, we heard a wonderful lesson last night from David Manning. David and Heidi are here. Great to see you guys. Thank you for being here tonight. Hope you all get to talk to them afterward. But for those of us that were here for the men's event, he just did a marvelous job with talking about the lost son. And I think I'll just kind of refer to that because, you know, he said the things that need to be said there. And just really caused me to think, I'll take a quick aside here and say, you know, he made a point last night about that's really not something that we speak enough about. And it was challenging. So, David, thank you for what you said last night. And it has really, you know, made me think about it in the last 24 hours a lot and in the ways that we need to love those who are lost and to be patient with those who are dealing with those situations. So thank you for that. You know, I'll make a quick point here. There's a little bit of a tulip trouble with these. I wouldn't hang my argument on Calvinism, you know, on these three parables, but just because it's here, we'll make a quick little point about it. You know, there's this thought in Calvinism about the limited atonement, that there's only certain ones that, you know, God handpicks and wants to have saved. And as many, I wouldn't, you know, draw on this too deeply, but you think about, you know, he doesn't say, well, that one sheep or that one coin or that one soul, well, that's their fault. You know, that wasn't one of my chosen ones. You know, we can let that one go. But no, he has a diligence toward that. He's not willing that any should perish, but that all could come to repentance and to salvation. So just quick point there. And then the last point is the, I guess, the famous Winston Churchill speech about never, 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 ever, ever, however many times he says it, give up. And that as long as there's breath, as long as the sun comes up, as long as there's opportunity, seek the lost. Be wise about that. Think about your approach, but be diligent as well. So, comments about the lost ones? Thoughts on that one? Okay, I'll move on to next one. This is a kind of an interesting one too. It's the NIV, the Bible here talks about, they call this one the dishonest manager. We might call this one the unjust steward is what we might have grown up hearing. Page 1430. And it's a little bit of a strange parable, but let's kind of run through it here. Jesus is talking to his disciples. And so the situation is there's a rich man who has a manager of his assets, of his wealth and all. And that manager has been found wasting the master's possessions. And so he's called on the carpet with that. He's caught, and he knows he's caught, and he knows he's going to be fired. And so he's being held accountable for that. The master is saying, you know, you can't be my manager anymore. Basically, here's your box. We're going to walk you to the door, and you're out. Give me your badge. Give me your keys. Maybe you've been through that situation. But that's what happens. This guy's getting walked to the door, so to speak. And so this manager panics, and he thinks, well, wow, what am I going to do? I'm getting fired. This is it. What are my alternatives? Well, I'm not strong enough to go out and do manual labor. I can't dig, as it says here. You know, I've got too much pride. I'm not going to sit out there and beg. I got to come up with something. So what am I going to do? Okay, I got an idea. I need to find a home. I need to find people that are going to take care of me when this happens and get me through this situation. So let's do this. Let's find these folks that do business with my master and owe him some money, and let's cut a deal. And that's what he does. He you know, this one that owes the master 900 gallons of olive oil. That's a lot of resource. And so this dishonest manager says, well, here, quickly, take your bill and let's cut that in half. Just write 450 on it or 400, whatever. Next one, same thing with, you know, bushels of wheat. You know, take the 1,000, mark it down to 800. And then this is kind of the weird part. You know, the master commends the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than the people of light. And you kind of hang up on that. You're like, well, wait a minute. Is he saying that we need to cheat, that we need to be dishonest, that we don't need to handle our responsibilities that are given to us in a way that's righteous and godly, but instead we should cut deals for ourselves to make sure that we can save our own skin and that we can, you know, survive? Is that what he's saying here? No, the parable goes on here, and then the speech from Jesus goes on. The key to it is he's talking about the people of the world, or their own kind, is what it might say there as well. So worldly people are shrewd, and they will deal with each other in worldly ways. But you, however, are different. You need to deal in godly ways. And so, you know, look at this next paragraph, you know. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. Whoever's dishonest in very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you haven't been trustworthy in handling the worldly wealth, what are you going to do with the true riches? And if you haven't been trustworthy with someone else's property, how are you going to have property of your own? And so thinking about that, you know, that's an essence of a godly and a Christian person, right? It's that doing the right thing when nobody else is looking. When you may think it's a very little thing, well, we can cheat just a little bit on that, or maybe we can sort of not quite look at the numbers that way. Let's maybe take a little credit. It's just a small thing after all. It's not going to matter. I'm just going to tell a little story about that, just, you know, because of convenience. It's no big deal. Is it no big deal? He says it's a big deal. And if you can't do little things right, how are you going to do big things right? And there's kind of a secret there. You know, they're all kind of big things in their own way. And there's not, you know, small things and big things. I mean, that's, you know, a general example. But the bottom line is, when it's up to you, when it's under your watch, do it right. Don't cheat. Don't be dishonest. Don't wash it away and say, well, it's just a little thing, I can get away with that. Because it's really not. And if you can't be honest in the little things, you can't be honest in big things. And so there are true riches there. You know, I think it's part of this is stewardship of our own lives here on earth, right? So we've been given this time, this life. We've been given resources. We've maybe been given the blessing of some health and some opportunity and all, and we should be good actors with that. We should be good stewards of those things. And it's not that we're going to earn our salvation because we're doing that. It's just that we're going to obey God and follow Him and live that righteous kind of life that He calls for us. And so then at the end is the context, and we talked a little about this on Sunday morning, around, you know, not serving two masters. You have to pick one, and you have to put that one at the top. And if you choose God and put Him at the top, everything else plays itself out and falls right into place, and you can follow that. So that's the dishonest manager or the unjust steward. Any thoughts or comments on him? Okay. We'll move on here. We can actually get through on time. All right. The rich man and Lazarus. This is maybe my second favorite one. I don't know. There's all the parables are so good in so many ways. And I'll tell you a quick story. You know, one of the great treasures that my family has on this earth is a Bible that belonged to my great-great-grandfather. Not sure which one it was. But it's this fantastic, it's a great big thing. It's, you know, like this, it's about that tall. The craftsmanship that went into the binding of the book, and there's just beautiful fonts and the way it's written. And there's fantastic, you know, artwork and illustrations in there. And it's, you know, it's a King James, and anyway, it's a beautiful treasure. And I can remember, you know, as a really little guy, and yes, I was little once, a long time ago, my mother had that out on a kind of a little display stand in our house, not for show, but just to kind of keep it and all. And I was always fascinated by that. And my mother and I would sit there, and I would, you know, carefully flip through the pages and look at the illustrations. And, you know, she would, you know, talk to me about the Bible and the stories there. And there was on the Rich Man and Lazarus page, there was an illustration kind of like that on the board. And, you know, I'll just, funny here, you know, I would say, you know, well, there's the rich man, and there's Lazarus, and there's moreover the dog. I thought it was funnier than that. But anyway, I thought the dog was moreover. It's not. If you read the moreover the dogs came, whatever. All right. Crash and burn. So yeah, this guy's in a tough situation here. You know, we know this story. These are very familiar parables. The rich man lives the life of luxury. You know, poor Lazarus doesn't have anything. They bring him to this rich man's gate. They lay him out there. He begs for crumbs. The dogs come. And anyway, they both pass away. And one of the things that we shouldn't miss in this parable is that there's a snapshot of life after death. And you wonder if he's speaking and if there are some maybe Sadducees there in the crowd. You know, they don't believe in the resurrection. And here he is giving this story that's all about life after death here on this life, in this life, and the rewards that come with those. And so each, you know, dies and goes to his reward. And there's just some haunting things in this parable. You know, the separation is one of the things that it's humbling to think about. You know, there's the great gulf that's fixed between the rich man that's in torment, Lazarus that's over in Abraham's bosom or paradise, and the fact that, you know, that you can't get from one side to the other, but apparently you can see the other side. And kind of let that wash over you. You know, you think about, for all of eternity, according to the story here, you're going to know. You're going to know. If you didn't make it, you're going to see over there. You know, the rich man calls to, you know, Father Abraham, have pity. Send Lazarus over here. I need water. Put some water on my tongue. I'm burning. I'm in agony here. Can't do it. Can't get there from here. You know, go back and tell my brothers about this. Well, they have the message, don't they? The message is sufficient. And sending someone back, you know, we have a chance here to make those right decisions and to understand, make, you know, good choices around faith, because we know what's coming there. So the message is sufficient. It's eternal. You know, the torment, the comfort is eternal. And as sometimes as tough as it can be here, as we think about time passing, and, you know, this will just never end, it really is just a blip when compared to eternity. So it's always been a great parable to challenge me to think about, you know, doing the right kinds of things, taking care of what we have here, looking around for those others that, you know, could benefit, and making sure that we're living our lives in a right kind of way. So any thoughts on Rich Man and Lazarus? All right, I really am going to finish. This is great. The next one, page 1439. This is the parable. This is the Luke account. This is in Luke chapter 19. It's the parable of the 10 minas. I don't know if I'm saying that word correct, but whatever. 10 minas. Very similar to what you'd find over on page 1452 in the Matthew account of the parable of the talents. I think that's the one that maybe we study and learn a little bit more about. And there are several things in the stories that are very similar. I don't know if they're the same story told different times or through a different lens. But anyway, we'll look at this one because it's in this week's reading, and probably not one that, as I'm thinking about, you know, reading about the parables, I probably wouldn't go to the Luke one. I'd probably go to the Matthew one more, just because that's familiar. So let's look at it from Luke's account here. And so there's a couple of differences in the story if you compare the two. You know, there it's a Christ is telling him a parable. I'm on the top of page 1439 here. And he says, you know, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. And he calls 10 of his servants and he gave them 10 minas. And he says, put this money to work until I come back. So let's pause there for a second. I think, you know, in the other story, it's just a man going into a far country. You know, this says he's going to be a king. And I guess I should stop and say, you know, let's think about Christ in this story, and let's see the analogy of Christ, and we should do that in all of the parables, of course, but this one is a pretty good one to do that. You know, the man, noble birth, going to another country to be king. That should be fairly straightforward. And the other one, it's only, you know, 3 servants. This one, each servant apparently gets the same amount of resource to get, and the other one it's 5 and 2 and 1, but whatever the point is, they all have something that doesn't belong to them that's been entrusted to their care with an expectation that they'll go out and do something with that and create a return, so that when the master, who is away in all these scenarios, not there every day watching them but trusting them with his resources, that when he does return, that he will have a reckoning for that. He'll have some expectation that they will have taken his investment and his what he has trusted with them, and that they will have generated that return for him. So anyway, then he goes, and interesting that this one talks about the subjects hated him, and they send a delegation after him to say that we don't want this man to be our king. You know, wasn't that certainly the situation there when Christ was alive? You think about, you know, he's come as the Messiah. He is not anything like what they thought he would be. He's not that physical, you know, great warrior, that David-like character that's going to come back and reestablish his throne and, you know, overthrow this awful, you know, Roman government that we're under, reestablish the glory of Israel. And I'm sure they're thinking, you know, Solomon and the glory and all the things that kind of went, you know, with that. That's what they're looking for in a Messiah. But as we have mentioned, you know, that's not what Jesus is all about. It's not that kind of a kingdom that he's bringing. And so there are those in this parable that are working to undermine that and just flat reject him as one, you know, to be the king. But they're not successful in that. It says he was made the king and he did return home. And he calls those servants in, those ones that he entrusted his resources to, and says, you know, okay, let's find out what you've done, what you've gained with what I've given you. And then very similar to the other, you know, there's one who comes back and has a great generated a lot of return on that investment. And the commendation, you know, well done, you've done very good. You've taken care of a small thing. I'm going to make you in charge of a large thing. So 10 cities is what he says here. Second one, similar, you know, his investment has returned 5 more. And so, you know, good job. That's what you're supposed to do. Great job in your investments. You're going to be in charge of some things as well. You get your reward. And then the third one comes back and, you know, very similar to the parable of the talents. You know, sir, here's your mina. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I think the other guy went and buried it in the ground. Point being, he did nothing with it. And he was afraid, but he knew. It's kind of confusing. You know, he even says, you know, I was afraid of you. This is the servant who hasn't generated anything back to his master. I was afraid of you. You know, you're a hard man. You take out what you didn't put in. You reap what you didn't sow. You know, can't you just hear the excuses? Well, I couldn't do it. You know, you expect too much. Come on, give me a break. You know, this is what, yeah. Just on and on, nothing, no. So the master kind of convicts him with his own words. He says, well, that's right. You knew that. You knew I was that way. You know I'm hard, and I look for things that I didn't put in. I reap where I didn't sow. You know, you could have at least gone and put it in the bank. You could have gotten just some simple interest out of it. You didn't even do that. You did nothing. You just sat on it. And so he has his reward as well. You know, his mina is taken away. given to the one that has made the 10. And, well, wait, that's not fair. That's not fair. You know, he already has 10. Well, to whom, you know, what does it say here? To whom, to everyone that has, and let me read it and say it the right way. To everyone who has, more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what they have will be taken away from them. And then there at the end, this is another interesting point of this particular account. He says, you know, bring those enemies, those ones who sent the delegation ahead and said, you know, we don't want this guy to be our king. Let's put in a bad word for him. You know, there's reckoning for those folks as well. And so they are eliminated. So interesting, again, I don't know if those are the same story told different ways or told a different time, but the points of it, the major points of it are the same. It's to, you know, take care of the investment. The king is trusting us with some things. We've all been given a lot, if you think of it that way, in terms of just resources or talents or abilities or opportunities, and we've been given our life here. Let's not squander that. Let's make sure that we're being about the Lord's business, taking care of things while he is away from us, so to speak. We know he's with us, but you know, there will be a time when he comes, and there will be a time when there is accountability to be had for that. So anyway, that was the parable of the 10 minas. That's a little different than the talents, but any comments or observations on that one? All right, you guys are quiet. All right, a couple more. Page 1445. This is, it's actually in three different places. It's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I guess Matthew 21:33 would be a good place to turn to sort of understand this. This would be the wicked vine dressers might be what some of the other titles you might see or what we might have referred to this parable in other terms there. And this is another one where we can really see Christ. Let's make sure we don't miss the imagery of the Messiah, the King, and the reward, all of those things in this parable as well. So the situation here, you know, there's a man who plants a vineyard. He puts the wall around it. He digs a pit for the wine press. He builds a watchtower. He makes this, you know, beautiful place that's going to, you know, produce things. And then he gives that place away to some others. He rents it out to some who can come and work that land and work that vineyard and get a return for him, take care of it, and hopefully get him some profit. And it's like the other one. He kind of goes away for a while. But then the season passes, and it's time to come back and look at the harvest. And it's not like the man is very greedy. You know, he wants some of the fruit from the vineyard. And so he sends a servant back to collect, and you know, they see the men who rent the vineyard are going to seize him and beat him, send him away empty-handed. And this happens about three times. You know, the owner sends those servants back, and it seems like each time they get a little bit worse, and you know, they treat the messenger, you know, shamefully. They beat him. They kill some of them, it says. And you just think, you know, wow, where's the justice in that? You know, the patience of this owner. And instead of, you know, calling the authorities or, you know, coming in, you know, he does send something that's incredibly special to him, a son that he loves. Ding, 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 flashing lights there. That's a big key to this parable, sending the son that he loves. And he sends him last of all saying, well, surely they'll at least respect my son. And these evil tenants, you know, wow, here he is, this is the heir. Let's kill him, then we're going to have this vineyard for ourselves. And that's what they did. They took him and they killed the man's son and threw him out of the vineyard. And so what naturally then is the question, what will the owner of the vineyard do? Well, he's going to come and he's going to seek retribution on those tenants that killed him and give that vineyard to others, as it says there. So obviously lots of messianic things going on in this parable here, right? You think about the message. You know, we've spent basically 8.5 months or so reading through an old covenant where, you know, God would say, you know, many, many, many times, you know, if you will follow me, keep my commandments, if you will obey me, if you will not chase after idols and do those things, then what? You know, I will be your God, you will be my people. Choose life. Or don't do those things. Don't follow me. Chase after the idols. Serve yourself. Make those bad choices. And that's a choice of death. And so he does come, and you know, that's part of the mission of Christ, is to come to, as it says, you know, later Paul would say to the Jew first and then to the Greek also. He comes to his own people. He comes to fulfill all of those prophecies. And what do? They reject him. They crucify him. They kill him. And then what happens? You know, the rejected stone, we can kind of keep reading on here. The stone that the builders rejected, this is in Matthew 21, about verse 42, has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it's marvelous. And he says, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you, given to a people who will produce its fruit. And then anyone who falls, and so forth. But the point being, they had the chance. They made the wicked choice. They didn't choose life. They choose death. And then what they had was taken and given to those who would respect it. So lots of great messianic and Christ things going on with that. Any thoughts on the vine dressers? All right, good deal. I think we're going to finish on time. This will be good. This is the last one. This is the wedding banquet. We're on page 1445 still. And I probably should have said this earlier. So oftentimes Christ will start these parables and say things like, the kingdom of heaven is like. So he's making it real clear what he's talking about. So we should, you know, be looking for the kingdom of heaven and what those analogies are within that parable and the story he's about to tell and what truths he's going to reveal about the kingdom of heaven in that story. So here's the wedding banquet. And so it's a king, again, having a wedding banquet for his son. Again, big red lights. Let's think about who he's talking about here. And so the king sends his servants to those who have been invited to the banquet and say, you know, hey, it's time to come. Let's come to the banquet. And they don't come. The guests don't come. They have other stuff to do. And so the king sends out some more servants and, you know, tell them I've prepared the dinner. You know, the oxen, the fatted cattle have been butchered. Everything is ready. As the song says, all things are ready. Come to the feast. It's here. The time's here. Please come. They don't. They pay no attention to him. One goes off to his field, another to his business. And then the others are just violent. You know, again, it's very violent stories here. They seize the servants, they mistreat them, they kill them. And that enrages the king. And so he destroys those, burns their city. And then again says to the servants, the banquet is ready, but those I invited did not deserve to come. So go to the street corners and invite anyone you can find. So he came to those invited guests first, gave them every opportunity. Not only did they reject, but they rejected in a very violent and awful kind of a way. So he opens it up for others. And so lots of folks come to the wedding, and then I guess at the end there's a man who's of this, you know, last round of invitees who comes and is not dressed in the wedding garment. And the king sees that, and he doesn't like that. And he asks him about it. Why don't you have your wedding clothes on? And the man just doesn't have an answer for it. And so they bound him, take him away, and then, you know, the last point here, the last sentence on that on page 1446, many are invited, but few are chosen. And we spent a little time on Sunday night, or Sunday morning, talking about the many and the few. So here's another example and a parable there. All right, so that's what I got for you tonight. And as we think about our reading in the next, you know, several days here, we're getting to the last week of the life of Christ. So many fantastic things are going to happen. You know, keep reading. Keep current with it. Try to read it fresh and resist the temptation to kind of skip. Yeah, I know that part. But really read it with fresh eyes, and I think it's always a wonderful and beneficial exercise to do that. So with that, I think we'll call it, and I appreciate your patience and your attention tonight. Thank you so much.